Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sarugon Rogue. And I am Sarugon, bringing you politics and perspectives on politics that maybe hadn't been obvious. So let's see what we can deal with. And just to start off, I couldn't help enjoying in a sarcastic sort of way an article written by Brendan O'Neill, the political columnist in Spiked, who's very much a supporter of Jews and Israel, and has written a book called After the Pogrom, which is about the 7th of October. So I highly recommend Brendan O'Neill on Spiked. And he has talked about the new president of Ireland. Now, he describes her essentially following on in the wake of what he describes as the smuggest pipsqueak of a politician, Michael D. Higgins, who really left his anti-Semitic, anti-Israel mark on Irish politics. Catherine Connolly is described as very left. She has described Hamas as being part of the fabric of the Palestinian people, and that Israel and its Western allies should not have anything to say about Hamas, who should not be ruled out from a government role. Now, I mean, it's very much the fact that Hamas is part of the fabric of Palestinian people that raises every question, and not the positive, sunny outlook that she has to it. He goes on to describe her as a socialist who wishes she was still in 1973, and says, think about Jeremy Corbyn in a pantsuit. But her anti-Semitic, anti-Israel position is really buttressed by the other areas of woke Kool-Aid that she appears to have drunk. She's very much a person who believes that a biological man can be a woman, and has an absolute belief that there are more than two genders. And she says it's up to the person who's making the decision to decide what gender they are. But it seems that she doesn't hold the same tolerance for any person deciding that they are essentially, there are only two genders. In regard to the question of whether trans athletes who have been through male puberty should be allowed to compete against women, she says it's complicated. She also feels that climate change is an existential threat. And she slams as disturbing and unacceptable, the language used by those of the Irish public who are against uncontrolled immigration. So all round, it seems we're dealing with a lady who doesn't reflect much of the zeitgeist of Ireland at all. And Israel withdrawing its embassy from Ireland was probably as much as you could do with that current situation. We were going to after, in the interview period, go slightly off track, and then in that sense we'll deal with the policing of free speech in the United Kingdom and what a disaster it has become, and take a little bit of a focus off South Africa in that respect.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'd like to dwell a little on the DA's new draft proposed private members bill legislation, which is intended to amend the Public Procurement Act. And it's also been called, they've entitled it, Economic Inclusion for All Bill. Now, with respect to procurement, one is dealing with the vexed question of ownership of companies and shareholding in companies based on race, and it has been a considerable imposition that, frankly, investors have just not seen South Africa as a viable destination for a whole lot of reasons, and they're all to be found in current government policy. But it was the 30% ownership in Starlink that Elon Musk railed against. And yet, it really questions justifiably that, you know, company ownership, first of all, it doesn't look like it looked 30 years ago when the idea was first mooted as our example of BEE and how to uplift people and implement them is a very limited thing. It is only available to people who ultimately are connected, and that is why politicians and businessmen and in many cases crooks often end up having that access to empowerment. It was never going to reach a significant number, a proportion of the population, and there is nothing like our unemployment figures to back that up. I mean, we recorded at the end of last year an unemployment rate of about 35.8%, and that took us well over 46% if you included in the count of people who are unemployed, people who've literally given up looking for work. And of course, that's happened more and more as there has been less and less investment in the economy through the impulse for people to create businesses and thereby necessitate the creation of employment. And we do have that conundrum of needing to provide as much employment as possible for people and minimize to the extent possible or feasible or it's all competitive investment in capital and less reliance on people. So our challenges are huge, and nothing that the ANC has done is pointing us out of that direction at all. It's just a doubling down on everything to do with broad-based black economic empowerement and BEE generally, and we've discussed that on numerous occasions. Now, some of the figures that the DA quotes as giving reason to why the whole idea of race-based ownership as a means of uplifting people does not remotely lead to equality is, to give you an idea, that from 2014 to 2024, the black unemployment rate increased by 8.6 percentage points, while white unemployment decreased by 1%. Now, that critics may say, well, you know, that points to why we need more participation in ownership of business. But the number of businesses you need in the country and the size of the businesses, the behemoths, the big businesses that can cope with the complexity of this process, are relatively few and far between. And these are not going to be the main drivers of employment, although they could significantly make a difference in the major industries such as agriculture and mining, and particularly, I think, an undervalued industry like tourism. So you've got this extraordinary divide, where the divide between poor black South Africans and the black middle class is greater than a divide between black and white. And you're just perpetuating an inequality amongst black South Africans and leaving the benefits of company ownership to a millionaire class, to those who can attract the contracts. And as we've seen from much of that comes out every day about corruption, abuse the systems and steal effectively large amounts of money, which are very often never result in a proper contract being complied with, or some just going to companies that cannot perform the services that they've in a corrupt manner have managed to get good contracts for. And of course it has a ripple effect, because it's procurement is about is largely about infrastructure spend for people. But the in order to meet the requirements that the government has for entering into contracts for government spend, which is another word for our spend, companies, private sector companies, have to reach higher levels of compliance to be included. It's and essentially what the ANC is saying is that inequality has been nothing. In fact, it's got worse by the fact that the emphasis on BEE is not at the most, at the broadest, ironically, the broadest, most basic level. And the idea is to repeal all race-based preferential procurement provisions and replace them with non-racial, outcomes-based empowerment framework. So this would be encouraging as opposed to penalizing, which is what current processes do. It would encourage genuine economic empowerment by offering incentives for tangible developmental outcomes. So we're looking at job creation, poverty reduction, skill enhancement, which is the key to getting onto and getting up the ladder and providing for yourself. And it is in so many respects obvious. But the Black Business Council, which came into being at the start of the dispensation, has simply described it as a continuation of apartheid, a nonsensical proposal, and it fails to deal with the imbalances of 92% of the population. The government only does business with big white business. These are not only unsustainable claims and retrogressive. Essentially, they haven't recognized any change or any development or what their role should be in this process. There are no statistics. They give no facts. They provide no research to justify their support for a system that does not touch the greater needs of our population.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'd like to welcome to this podcast Simon Lincoln Reeder, who is really a man who regards the issues of free speech and the importance of those rights, with specific reference to the situation in the United Kingdom. And we're in the very situation of watching literally our police forces sort of battle for turf of the soul of the country and for their role in protecting, supposedly protecting the population. But the UK, as much of the Anglosphere, has a very different set of problems, and that is that they've turned, I suppose almost one could say, banality and almost fanciful notions into the basis for whether speech should be heard or not heard, or policed or not policed. And in with specific regard now, we have a look at the case of the comedian, the writer, the comedy writer, very successful comedy writer, Graham Linehan. Simon, do you just want a very brief idea of what Simon Linehan's sort of misdeeds have been that caused him to come to the attention, and more than the attention, of the UK police recently?
Sure. Sorry, and thanks for having me. Graham Linehan is an Irish comedy writer, and he achieved considerable success with his sitcoms, Father Ted, The IT Crowd, Black Books. I think Father Ted is the most well-known, but The IT Crowd had the longest run on television. And this really endeared him to the arts sector, and he won a number of accolades, deservedly so. But at some point in the last decade, he started exploring identity politics from the position of feminism. And he was one of the first men who came out the gates with, you know, I stand for women's rights. And he was seeing women's rights, which he regarded as hard fought, as being attacked mainly from the online subversive right. And this propelled him into Twitter warfare. But what he quickly discovered was that it wasn't actually the right that were attacking women's women and women's rights. It was more the interest groups, and in particular Stonewall. And when they saw him exploring and discovering where these attacks were coming from, they turned their guns on him. And that led to what you could quite accurately describe as the end of his career and huge damage to his life. He lost his marriage. He lost royalties from future work. He had a play that was being built around the image of Father Ted, which was cancelled. And, you know, if you look at what these groups had done and what he discovered was that they had infiltrated the institutions, penetrated or captured even. And these institutions are the police, the civil service, and to a large extent, corporations as well. And that really is the background from which his arrest at Heathrow Airport at the beginning of September should be examined. He was coming from Arizona, from where he now lives. He's had to leave the UK for obvious reasons, intimidation, and the fact that he doesn't have any prospect of work here. His reputation has been severely damaged. But he was coming here to contest a charge of harassment in the Westminster High Court that had been leveled against him from a young trans activist. Whilst he was in midair, another trans activist who was formerly a policeman launched a complaint, which led to his arrest by five armed officers at Heathrow and his subsequent hospitalization on account of blood pressure. Now, he has successfully had these charges, the latter charges by the former policeman, thrown out. The police will not be investigating. But just the spectacle of his arrest, just the grounds upon which this happened, have really set alight the debate to quite an angry point. And that's where the situation currently stands.
And I gather the consequence of this, and it's largely about his comments in the transgender debate, which most of which we consider common sense to most people, and if I can call it the mainstream, that gender dysphoria is a subject that needs to be, people suffering from it needs to be supported. Transgender women are not biological women. The concern of intervention in children and underage teenagers with puberty blockers and interventions of that nature. So we're not exactly looking at something that is set in stone for his detractors in the science. Sure. Now, the consequence of this has been that these incidents that are reported for possibly contravening public sector violence or potential inciting of violence are not actually crimes. They're not on the statute book. They're not in legislation. They're not in the common law. Somebody makes a report. The police act on it. They investigate. They ultimately, by and large, have appeared to have fallen through. This seems to give succor to the accusation against the British police that there's levels of two-tier policing, that real policing on substantial social disruption grounds is not happening, while they're literally monitoring people's speech. I mean, this very idea that a police force can become essentially a set of nannies is extraordinary, and it's been. The criticism has been reignited over the issue of the anti-Israel rallies and the responses to the perpetrators and the victims of those rallies.
Correct. Look, I think non-crime hate incidents need some exploration here in the context of Graham Linehan. But in 2005, all the way back then, so we've had two decades of this festering. And, you know, it's Gramsci's principle, isn't it? It's the slow bleed through your institutions, and then everyone wakes up way too late. And that's precisely what's happened here. I think the idea was in line with Tony Blair's general view on society, in that you were civilized enough and everyone was educated enough to be able to enhance order so that people would see non-crime hate incidents as unacceptable irrespective of free speech grounds, and that society would adopt a much more civilized, decent approach in corresponding with one another. And that's absolute nonsense. And it's fanciful, and it completely ignores instinct and, quite frankly, the ideas which were shared in the Enlightenment. Now, you've had, as I said, two decades of this. What happened in those two decades that we weren't aware of is that these, and particularly Stonewall, who I referenced just now, would go into constabularies across the country, and they would identify personnel within those constabularies to make diversity champions or LGBT champions. So essentially you had a third party incentivizing an organ of state, which is completely unacceptable. And I don't know how any constitutional grounds can be made to support that. But this is what officers did. And then there are practical explanations too. It's much easier for a policeman to investigate what someone said on social media than it is to go and explore the trail of a stolen car. And it suddenly it became popular because not only was it easier, but you had a status associated by this third party. So all of this has, I hope, and this is maybe a false hope, but I hope that Graham Linehan's unfortunate turmoil has shone a spotlight so bright that the police just can't do this anymore. They can't do it. There's a reputational damage. There's a competency question. And I think, you know, a lot needs to be done to explore how it got this bad. And when people complain about, you know, the police, there are grounds for doing so. There's the percentage of convictions that result from burglaries and car thefts is really, really bad for a developed country. And the public discourse now, that if you like, the zeitgeist, is that it's this bad because they have been emphasizing these ridiculous non-crime hate incidents so frequently and with such zeal and prominence. So that's where, you know, that's where we kind of are with these things. And I think the public too, even I'm sensing from the left, who you would ordinarily associate support, they're beginning to tire of this. And look, you just can't measure it, can you? You can't say that you created a better society because you policed non-crime incidents, hate incidents with, you know, it just doesn't provide the results. And I think everyone's sensing that now.
One always gets a sense that it sort of goes to the decline of a civilization when the minutiae that don't actually assist the bedrock of the society to develop in any way, both economically and scientifically and factually and in the creative sense, becomes literally inverted. And the obsession becomes with the minutiae, and you're dealing with an internet. The internet cannot be policed in that way. I mean, you have to police the internet for larger, genuinely worrisome potential crimes that could affect society as a whole. But this is essentially pursuing, you know, deciding that somebody slagging off unacceptably and a million other people slagging off unacceptably is fine. It's almost juvenile. The inversion of priorities is so bad, and one wonders how I got to that. And I say that having just read an article on San Francisco, which was very much an example of this writ large in all aspects of the governance of the city, and that finally getting back a more stronger enforcement of police enforcement against crime is shifting very much already. It's fortunate enough to shifting the way people are viewing and going back to and returning to a city like San Francisco. So I just don't, as I said, it's almost like the eruption that the internet has created has caused us to sort of lose our perspective and our rationality, and it undermines everything that we should be standing for and worrying about.
Yeah, look, it goes back to those priorities. And, you know, I'd like to ask the compilers of the police guidebook, the Royal College of Policing, what exactly were you hoping to accomplish? What measurements did you have in place for this? And how, because all I see and all I can feel is simply a public wave of revulsion now, in that this strategy has created more distrust. It's created more anger. And as it relates to a collective respect of the police, and never forget, I think this is an important point here. There was the profile of the Bobby as a friend to the public, much more so than most other countries. And this was a stern, commanding, but ultimately largely benign influence in public life. And you respected it because it knew what the rules were. And as long as you abided by the rules, you could have a reasonable relationship. There was none of the distrust that you see in countries like South Africa. That profile is something that a society works incredibly hard to forge. And it has to be maintained by discipline. Together with the response from the police during the COVID lockdowns and the non-crime hate incidents, you've seen such a level of decline in the trust of this institution. I don't believe that they understand it properly. They never saw it as a fixture of free speech. And they didn't know how to. And the tradition for the longest time in the UK was that it was almost like a family inheritance. If a father was a policeman, his son would be a policeman. And that changed with Tony Blair again, because he decided that every single police official should have a university degree. So you've got this kind of like cleverer than you attitude that crept in, and that didn't sort of couldn't rely on those inherited instincts as to how to calm us, how to de-escalate, how to negotiate between warring, arguing parties. You prioritize someone who's threatening to blow up something, to kill someone, who's distributing banned material, trying to sell drugs, the stuff that you find on the dark web. For most other situations, you've got to apply a level of discretionary judgment, faculty that shows you, okay, this is actually nothing. If Graham Linehan says to one of his critics that he's going to punch them in where it hurts, it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's probably symptomatic of the complaint of the elites in countries like the UK, where there's really a sense of sort of moral and perhaps intellectual authority that completely ignores the reality on the ground, the common sense. The accusations of that being disconnected from the people has become such an issue here and in the UK. It's very much a reflection of that. In this regard, I'd like to look at the situation of the Oxford Union, the debating union, and its president-elect, who, having once debated Charlie Kirk, and on his death made comments that make him completely unfit for purpose. Simon, you've got some real understanding of what has happened and what is happening in that respect. And as what appears to me to a complete degradation of what should be an intellectually significant force in the country, just dissipating.
Yeah. Well, it's like the university. I mean, they are separate institutions, but they feed into each other in that the president-elect is elected by weight of numbers from members of the university. But, the Oxford Union was established, I think, in 1823, 8 years after the end of the Enlightenment. It was done so to complement the ideas and not just complement them, the understanding that ideas don't just end. You consistently need better ones, more ideas. And you've had prime ministers, you've had royalty, you have actors and even sports people who come to debate. And yes, shortly after the murder of Charlie Kirk, it emerged that the incoming president, George Abaronye, had been celebrating his death. And, you know, that's not an item of free speech. That is an item of someone who doesn't meet the threshold of quality being parachuted into a role that he is not fit to occupy. That's what this comes down to. And he can be seen saying that some institutions are so cancerous and rotten that the only thing you can do is to burn them all down, basically encouraging violent insurrection in the place of the free exchange of ideas. Okay, he shouldn't even be at Oxford. He is a recipient of lower admission standards. And that speaks to this conscience of an institution that feels it needs, it has to modernize or whatever. That shouldn't be the case. Oxford University was always one of the pillars of English exceptionalism. He calls a vote of no confidence in his pending presidency because he is of the view that things have changed so drastically since 2020 that zeitgeist will be on his side and that public opinion has, depending upon which way you look at it, either progressed or submitted enough to see someone like this achieve the necessary amount of support to occupy the presidency. The results are very clear. The extraordinary returning officer charged with tabling the votes and then releasing the outcome to the public. And throughout that period, he is intimidated and harassed by supporters and representatives of George Abaronye. Now, that's unacceptable. That should never happen. We are talking to the finest and most prestigious debating institution in the world. And now this guy is not being allowed to do his job properly. So those results were released, and he has failed. There were enough votes from life members to ensure that he received no confidence. So he, I think there were something like 1,228 votes against him in a no vote that he called. I think maybe 500 or just less than 500 no's, and then a couple of abstentions. But the point is that he was he's out. Okay, what he's now done is he's contested this by saying that the incumbent president behaved in a manner which made a fair vote impossible. So he's brought a vote of no confidence in the incumbent. But if you just look at the reactions from life members, some of whom are prominent politicians, business people, they are so disgusted at what has happened to this institution. And you know, for speaking from our perspective, Sarah, from a free speech advocacy, it is a very sad thing to see free speech being tormented by these sorts of destructive forces. He's got no new ideas. He's just one of these guys that have ridden a wave since 2020, and the damage is very, very clear. And the reputation of this institution has been dragged through the mud, and I think that that's a very, very sad thing.
I think what it also points to is the fact that there is a distinction between free speech and the consequences of your speech. You can say what you like, but you do take risks that what you say or how you say it will have consequences. They're not always formal. They may be a response from a large number of people, as have happened in the case of Graham Linehan, but positive or negative, but you do take consequences. And if you're going to stand as president-elect of what is, as you say, a truly prestigious institution that really goes to the intellectual heart of a society, if there's blowback and you lose that position or you lose the chance to become president, you take responsibility for it by the way in which you dealt with the matter, that you did not apply well thought out principles and alternative arguments. It's the manner in which you do it. It's what you say. It's what you give of yourself. And he tried to defend himself for saying what he said didn't reflect his values, which suggests at best he has no values, and at worst he has really terrible values.
You can't have people who make those sorts of comments holding the office that is an office that is whereupon impartiality and sound judgment are expected. We're interested in these offices being held by people who've got interesting ideas upon which other ideas may emerge, from which discussion may flow. And he can say what he wants. The fact is that he has a prestigious position in which he is meant to illustrate sound judgment, when he is meant to illustrate a form of commanding leadership, which prompts a really healthy debating atmosphere. He doesn't do that. So that's the position that we are examining this from.
So, Simon, your overall sense of institutions, do you see them coming out of this sort of what I call this 2020 moment of madness, or is it going to take very much longer if they actually survive it sufficiently at all?
I have no faith that we are making any progress here. Toby Young, who you know, he refers to it as a hydra. As soon as one head is cut off or rather defeated in court, another emerges. And we have a level of management in this country, be it in the civil service or in private enterprise, that is packed with university graduates and subsequently has a way of thinking about free speech that is completely in contrast to its purest forms. And I can't see that being undone within the next decade. I think it's going to take a lot longer. But because this is an issue that you really have to apply a quality judgment to, I just don't think that they're in the position. And it has expanded into the public service, especially since 2020, into public private business rather. So together these forces present an enormous obstacle. There's one way to react to this symptomatically, which means that you get the right lawyers, you join the right unions like ours, you speak out as often as you can, and that saves you from the knock at the door. But how do you encourage a resistance to a process that's gone on whilst you slept for the last 20 years? It's a very, very difficult thing to try and influence institutions to change. And if you don't have the political willpower here, which we very evidently don't, then I can't see it changing, unfortunately. If you're someone who doesn't have any status, you don't have any meaningful societal participation, but for a Twitter feed in which you make limericks or jokes, you know, you're fair game for the police still. You will be.
Whatever our humongous problems are in this country, we might see a change in governance that's more meaningful sooner than you guys will, which is quite a thought to conjure with.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, priorities speak for themselves. And as it relates to what you're seeing on television, I've been watching the Madlanga Commission, and I think this country might not have that level of malaise as it relates to the corruption within institutions. But you could argue that they are intellectually corrupt because the attitude toward this foundational freedom is not as it should be, and it's being resisted, and attempts to change it are being resisted, which is, you know, as you say, it's a very, very deep problem.
Mm-hmm. Simon, thank you very much for joining me.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Just a couple of comments on the ANC succession race. My view would be that the way things stand at the moment, there is nothing that the ANC or no one that the ANC could put forward that would really garner public support, although it's not up to the public or the voters to do anything about it. It's these are internal processes, as they usually are. But when you think that the front runner for the ANC, for someone to replace Soroma Maposa, is Paul Mashatile, who, despite his very not insignificant credentials during the awful high water mark period of conflict over apartheid, is an unofficial biography of him by Peter du Toit has essentially confirmed that since he has had a position of authority with Minister of Settlements and tried to implement Alexandra Renewal Project, nothing he has done in government, never mind for the ANC, nothing he's done in government has actually been a success. And his the corruption and the favors and the living high off the hog, really, you know, we know a lot about it. So there you've got a person who, certainly my exposure to him once publicly was that his delivery, he was boring. There was nothing interesting in anything he had to say. And he, like, I think the one thing he has in common with the other potential contenders, unlike Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa, there's absolutely no sense of charm. There's no sense of being amenable to the people. And the other people that are really being looked at as possibilities are Senzo Mkhwanazi, who's now in trouble because he's the suspended Minister of Police in a saga that just elaborates upon how bad our security sector is. And people like Nomvula Mokonyane, who has had a terrible reputation both as Gauteng Minister of Water and Sanitation, Communication. And she just did the rounds, and she's really, I mean, if these are the people that they're looking to, as well as the minister in the presidency, it's really terrifying that people like Kumbutso and Chivani and Panyaza Lesufi, the current Gauteng Premier, if that's what the ANC is going to rely on to make them more successful than they were, rather than very much less successful in the next national and provincial election, you really do have to wonder. It's virtually for almost anybody else to lose the election rather than for the ANC to win it. It's a terrible situation, and it denotes a political party that is completely operating within its own bubble and incapable of looking to the people it's actually meant to serve. Those have long become irrelevant. Well, to encourage you to return next week to look at more issues of politics and politics adjacent subjects, I'd also commend you to my Substack, which is at Sara Gone Rogue, which is at sara281.substack.com, to just get ideas to broader areas in the political sphere, or to prove the point that actually everything is ultimately politics. Look forward to seeing you then.